Thanks for coming tonight to another lecture at the Amherst Center for Christian Studies. Dr. Robert Orr, and that's Bob to all of you, by the way, got his MD from McGill University in 1966. He did residency training in family medicine and engaged in private practice in Vermont for 18 years, where he was named the Vermont Family Doctor of the Year in 1989. A growing interest and involvement in medical ethics led him to pursue a postdoctoral fellowship at the Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Chicago from 1989 to 1990. And from 1990 to 2000, he was the Director of Clinical Ethics and Professor of Family Medicine at Loma Linda University in Southern California. He was honored by the AMA in 1999 when they gave him the Isaac Hayes and John Bell Award for Leadership in Medical Ethics and Professionalism. In 2000, he returned to Vermont as Director of Ethics at the Fletcher Allen Health Care Center and the University of Vermont College of Medicine. He retired from the hospital position in 2006, but continues to serve as a volunteer clinical ethicist. In addition, he lectures, teaches, and writes about clinical ethics and end-of-life care. Dr. Orr has academic appointments at the University of Vermont, Loma Linda University, Trinity International University in Illinois, and the Graduate College of Union University in New York. He's co-authored 2 books, co-edited 3 others, contributed 11 book chapters, and over 100 articles related to clinical ethics, the ethical consultation process, and issues in terminal care. His most recent book, Medical Ethics and the Faith Factor, will be released by Erdmans in 2008. He's lectured regionally, nationally in 30 states, and internationally on 6 continents. He chaired the Council on Ethical Affairs for the California Medical Association and was vice president of the American Society for Bioethics and the Humanities. He served on the Ethics Commission of the Christian Medical Dental Association and served as chairman of that commission from 1991 to 1994. He has recently served as the first scholar in residence at the Kilns, the restored home of C.S. Lewis in Oxford, England. Please welcome Dr. Rohr.
Thank you for that introduction. Thank you for the invitation to come. I'm really delighted to learn about the ministry here and the environment, and I'm looking forward to sharing a few thoughts with you about my pilgrimage. I've known Ron and Nancy Lozier for many years, more years than either any of us care to remember. And when they asked me to come and speak, they didn't tell me how long I should talk. So I've prepared a talk for 3 hours. But I've promised to try to condense it to an hour or so, and then hope to leave some time at the end that we can have some discussion. In fact, I feel pretty informal about this, so if you have a question as I'm moving forward, just feel free to either blurt it out or raise your hand or whatever. And if we never get to the end of the outline, that's perfectly fine with me. I hope you all have 2 things. One is the outline of some of the thoughts, and the other is an article that I authored recently about the role of Christian belief in public policy. So let's talk a little bit about medical ethics. What's it all about? What do you think of when you think of medical ethics? You probably think of stem cell research, cloning, abortion, euthanasia, those things. And they are current. They are topics. Some of them are hot buttons, in fact. But where did medical ethics come from? Well, when you ask somebody about a particular issue, they will often say, well, what does the Hippocratic Oath say about that? And truly, Hippocrates was sort of the father of modern medicine and the father of medical ethics. But about 10 years ago, I did a study of all the medical schools in North America, the allopathic and osteopathic medical schools, to see what oath they used when students graduate. Because almost every school, at the time of graduation, you're now a physician, and you take this oath. So out of 150 schools, how many do you think use the Hippocratic Oath?
I guess it's all, but obviously it's wrong.
10.
Wow. What a skeptic. Actually, the answer is 1.
Wow. Oh, wow.
1 out of 150. Most of them use something called the Declaration of Geneva, which was written by the World Medical Association in the 1940s, but it, along with the Hippocratic Oath, proscribed abortion and euthanasia. And so many schools have adopted an updated version of the Declaration of Geneva, which does not mention those 2 issues. And other schools use their own unique one, or the Oath of Maimonides, the Prayer of Maimonides, and so on. but only one looks back as far as Hippocrates for its guiding light. And I don't pretend that the Hippocratic Oath is gospel, but it certainly is a strong foundation, and I think something that's worthy of note and emulation. But if you look historically at the work of Hippocrates, not only his oath, but the other writings of his training, he focuses on competence, that physicians need to do a good job. Still a valid focus. But there's a medical historian named Albert Johnson who wrote an interesting book about 15 or 20 years ago called The New Medicine and the Old Ethic. And he's a Catholic believer, and he maintains that the competence emphasized by Hippocrates has been joined with the compassion taught by Jesus the Christ to form the ethos of medicine, which had been in place for hundreds of years. And it's only in recent decades that has begun to dissolve, fall apart. Can't talk about the history of medical ethics without mentioning Thomas Percival, because he's the first person, a believer, by the way, first person who wrote a book entitled Medical Ethics. In fact, I think he coined that phrase. It was published in 1803, but it really wasn't about anything that we think about in relation to medical ethics today. It was about professional ethics. It was about etiquette, about how to interact with other physicians and so on. Still, it's a classic work. But contemporary medical ethics, what we think of when you hear that phrase, that he really started in the 1960s, 1970s, by theologians asking questions of physicians. Should you be doing that? A lot had to do with the abortion issue, but there are other issues as well. But it was people coming from a theological base, Catholic, Jewish, Protestant, Orthodox, but coming from a theological focus, saying, let's address some of these questions. Sadly, that theological voice has been marginalized and quieted over time. And the primary voices in medical ethics today are by philosophers and attorneys and health policy people. The theological voice, the religious voice, has been marginalized. So that now, really, it's a thoroughly secular endeavor. In fact, a little vignette. Several years ago now, I've forgotten, 5 or 6 years ago, I received a phone call from a colleague that I barely knew, an attorney who teaches medical ethics at the University of Rochester. And she asked if I would serve with her and three others on a panel at a professional bioethics meeting. I said, well, maybe. Tell me a little bit about it. He said, well, the title of our panel is Bioethics and the Fundamentalist Agenda. I said, no, I don't think so. I said, but tell me a little more. Why are you doing this and why the title and so on? He said, well, I'm doing it because I've noticed 20, 25 or more websites of organizations or individuals who are talking about medical ethics, and they are coming from a religious perspective. And I can't figure out what it is they're trying to do. And she listed some, and it happened that I was served on the board of two of those organizations, which may be why she called me. And I've made it fairly clear in my presentations that I come from a faith perspective. So I wasn't totally surprised, but I said, you know, I'm not really sure that I can fit with your title. I mean, she told me the other three people, herself and three others, and I knew all of them, none of them were people of faith. In fact, we're quite antagonistic to issues of faith. And I don't really feel like being a whipping boy or a token fundamentalist or whatever. And I said, in fact, I don't consider myself a fundamentalist. I think that's a term that has particular meaning in circles that I am involved with, and it doesn't fit. But I said, what do you mean by fundamentalist? He said, well, a fundamentalist is a person who accepts sacred writings and tries to base their life on it. I said, well, sign me up. I'm a fundamentalist by that definition. I said, I'll do it under just one provision. This is a small meeting, generally about 75 professional ethics people. And they break up into small groups, so there are five sessions going on at any one time, so you expect about 15 audience. So I said, if, and traditionally, when you start each session, every person introduces themselves by name and their institution. And I said, how would it be if, when we have introductions in the room, we give name, institution, and then just one sentence about their faith tradition? And she said, yeah, no harm. Well, it turned out that it was a very popular session. 35 out of 75 people came to it. And if we went around the room, there were two people who identified a current faith tradition, myself and a Unitarian. All the rest identified themselves as either atheist or agnostic or former Baptist, used to be Catholic, recovering Methodist, all kinds of pejorative and historical things as if they had been exposed to or raised in a faith tradition and had rejected it. So it was an interesting endeavor. And I tried to point out that the basis of contemporary ethics, the beginning, was from theology, and it's now been marginalized. And why is that? Is it because the people in ethics have pushed away the religious voice, or because people have withdrawn because they feel unaccepted or whatever? So it's actually an interesting session and pretty well received. So that's the sort of the scope of where I'm coming from. My interest in ethics is even narrower than that, however. I consider myself a clinical ethicist. Rather than being involved in a lot of theory, somewhat in policy issues, but primarily I'm a clinical ethics consultant. So that I get called by a physician or a nurse or chaplain or a social worker or family member or patient saying, we don't know what to do here. We've got a dilemma, or we've got two options and we're not sure which is the best. Can you help us figure out what to do? Some people misunderstand my role, and they think that I come in and say, this is what should be done. Hardly ever. Once in a while, I can't help myself. And there's really only one way. And more often than not, I'd like to say this. But generally, what I do is I look at the situation, talk to all individuals involved, do an ethical analysis, and then create a box and say, it would be ethically permissible to do option A or option B or option C. But options D, E, and F are outside the boundary of accepted medical practice. So I'm really drawing boundaries. Sometimes there are only a few options, or sometimes they're struggling between two. And I may say that option A is ethically has more ethical merit, but option B is still ethically permissible, with some reasoning and so on. But how do I get there? Well, we have to look at standards. Now, some people in clinical ethics, medical ethics, think really everything is relative, and that they're really the standards are set by the individual, and the ethics role is to be a facilitator, to be sure that all the options are considered. I have a narrower perspective of that, and I think there are standards. And there are really four different types of standards. There are professional standards of what is acceptable, focusing on the patient's best interests. That's a professional standard. A fiduciary responsibility. That's a term that I didn't understand until just a few years ago. I thought fiduciary had to do with money. It doesn't. It has to do with trust. A fiduciary relationship is an uneven relationship where one person has more training, knowledge, background than the other, and so that person has a fiduciary responsibility to act in this person's best interest. So you have a fiduciary relationship with your physician, with your dentist, with your accountant, with your banker. Those are all fiduciary relationships. But that's part of the professional relationship. And I consider one of the professional standards is that the doctor-patient relationship is a covenantal relationship. It's a promissory relationship. I promise to seek your best interests. Unfortunately, tragically, I think over the last generation, that has slowly, I was going to say evolved, devolved into a concept that it's a contractual relationship, that you have two parties who negotiate over what the rules are and what's going to be done, and then you follow the contract. And I think that's a deprofessionalization of the practice of medicine. So in addition to professional standards, there are legal standards. The law says you can do this, you can't do that. Now, as a little tangent, there are really two types of legal standards. which you may or may not be aware of. There's statutory law. That's a law that's drawn up by the state legislature or the U.S. Congress, and that's the law. But then there are other issues that are not addressed in statutory law. They go to court, and the court determines what should be done in this case. That's called case law. Now, if you have an irresolvable conflict about a patient care that goes to court, and the court makes a decision, this is what will be done, that only applies to that case. But if that case is appealed to a higher court, then the decision of the higher court has precedent and jurisdiction for however far that court's jurisdiction goes, all the way up to the state Supreme Court. Actually, I think it's in Massachusetts that the Supreme Court is called something else, Supreme Judicial or something. Anyway, every state has a highest level. And then, of course, in the federal system, there's the Supreme Court. So case law is a little bit tricky. You may hear about a case law of Karen Quinlan. Some of you are old enough to remember Karen Quinlan back in 1976. That went to the Supreme Court in New Jersey. And so really, that only had precedent in the state of New Jersey, but it's been adopted as a standard in many other jurisdictions. So cases that go to the U.S. Supreme Court, like Nancy Cruzan in 1990, that has total national jurisdiction. So there are legal standards. The third type of standards is ethical standards. And these are a little less clear. But there are some things that are general consensus. And I have attached to the back of this handout two pages that I'm not going to discuss. And what did I label it? Bioethics consensus statements. And especially you who are pre-med students may want to hold on to this, because here are 17 things that are generally accepted as valid in the ethics milieu. And you can look at those sometime at your leisure. But those are pretty well accepted standards. But then there are unique cases. I mean, a specific case may have some unique features. Let me tell you a story. I love to tell stories. I teach mostly by stories. But let me tell you about a case that's unique, doesn't fit any of the standards, and you try to figure out what should be done. Heavy girl, 12 and a half, almost 13, who got an infection in her knee, was kind of sick, a little fever, and so on, and then suddenly got very sick. Was admitted to the hospital. She was being treated with antibiotics. She got admitted to the hospital, and it was obviously not responding to those antibiotics, and she got a systemic infection that went into her bones, into her lungs. She was very, very ill. They isolated what the bacteria was and were treating her with appropriate antibiotics, had to operate on her leg to drain the infection in the bone. And then she had these two things that are called pleural effusions, big, thick, pussy collections of fluid between the lung and the chest wall. And you got to get that out of there. You're not going to get better unless you get it out of there. So they'd stick needles in, they put tubes in, they tried to drain it out, couldn't get it out because it was so thick and loculated into little areas they couldn't drain it. And so the only treatment was to open her chest and peel off this thick. I mean, it's big surgery, but it's doable. But there was a problem. She had now been sick for about 3 weeks. And during that time, her blood count had dropped down to a very anemic level, and she and her family were Jehovah's Witnesses and would not accept blood transfusion. And the surgeon was willing to do the operation, but he says, I won't do it unless I can give her blood, because it's too dangerous. If we do the operation without giving her blood, she may well die from the procedure, because peeling this stuff off is a very bloody operation, and you lose a lot of blood. So they asked for an ethics consult, saying, what should we do? So what should we do? Yes?
Honor the Jehovah Witness. I mean, were there family members in the Jehovah Witness?
Yes, the family situation was that, I don't know how familiar you are with the Jehovah's Witness tradition, they don't have pastors, they have elders in their local congregation. And the patient's father was, no, I'm sorry, her uncle and her father's father were elders in different congregations. Her family had been in that faith tradition for over 20 years. She herself, at age 12 and three quarters, had just completed the training and had been accepted in her local community as a Jehovah's Witness.
What was her judgment?
Her judgment was, I talked with her, and I actually had to make a decision as I was, after I had reviewed the chart and talked with the doctors and nurses. Her family was in her room, and I was going in to talk with them and with her, and I had to make a decision about whether to talk with her alone or talk with her with family present. What do you think?
Alone first.
Alone first. A lot of people say that, and I think there's a valid reason for that, because you really want to know what she thinks. But at the same time, I didn't want to alienate the family. And so what I did was sort of a compromise. I walked in the room, introduced myself, told them why I was there, and said that I wanted to try to help them, help everybody make the best decision we could. And I said, I'm here, I want to talk with, I forget her first name now. Oh, I remember, but I won't tell you. I want to talk with Jane. But you folks are welcome to stay and listen. But I want her responses. I don't want you responding. I don't want you telling her what to say. I want to hear what she has to say. So, what would you ask her? Question.
What did she say?
Well, what did you ask?
Well, she's 12 and a half.
Yeah.
She's a minor.
Yeah.
She can't make her own decisions for surgery, can she?
Who says?
I don't know. I'm asking.
The law says. The case law.
You don't understand the seriousness of your condition.
Right. That's a great place to start. Tell me. In fact, I'm going back one step further. Tell me, what's going on? And she told me about the infection. She told me about the pus. She told me, and I said, and what if the doctor suggested? Operation. I said, and why has it become a problem? Blood. So she had a good understanding. But that's the place to start. How much does the patient understand? Because the question that you raise is pivotal. Is she able to make this decision as a 12-and-a-half-year-old? Because the court has said, long, strong precedent, that individuals under the age of 18 are under the jurisdiction of their parents, and the parents' wishes should be followed unless it represents a danger to the child, and then a court can impose treatment over parental objections. So that's the legal standard.
I have a question. What was the prognosis if she didn't have the surgery, or if she had the surgery without the blood transfusion?
Good questions. Very important. And I tried to get as clear answers for those as I could from the specialists. And they said, without the operation, she's probably going to die in the long run, but it may be a long time. We keep give her antibiotics, and that will kill the bugs that escape into the bloodstream, but we can't get after the infection in the chest because the antibiotic just won't get in there. And so if we can't get that out of there, she's probably going to die, but it may be weeks or months. Doing the operation without blood transfusion, the surgeon was just, in fact, all the pediatric surgeons at that hospital were unwilling. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, we could discuss whether or not that's appropriate or whether we should try to get somebody else involved, but they were unwilling at that time. So I don't want to spend the whole evening on a case, but so let me sort of fast forward ahead. Oh, one other important piece of information. Oh, I did ask her, and what do you want us to do? And she said, I'm trying to think of her exact words because I had to push her a little bit on it. Oh, she said, I don't want you to use blood if possible. And I said, so if it's not possible, then it's okay if we give you blood? She said, no. She said, and then she started to cry, and she said, I would rather die than accept blood. And, I mean, the belief of the Jehovah's Witness community is that Jehovah said, thou shalt not accept blood, because if you do, then there's eternal separation from Jehovah. Very important issue. This is not peanuts. Now, I think it's wrong, and I think their interpretation of Scripture is wrong. But that was her belief. That's what she said to me. And then she was getting a little short of breath by this time, so I said, let's take a rest. You rest a little bit. I'm going to talk with your parents outside, talk with them, and told them about the legal precedent and that we might have to go to court. But the other important historical information is that the patient's school teacher had been to visit just the day before my consultation and had told the nurses that this patient was one of the most mature eighth graders she had ever had, or seventh grade, whatever it was, that she felt she was intellectually, socially, psychologically more mature than most her age. And I asked her while I was talking with her about what it meant if she did receive blood and so on, and she had quick answers, sounded a little bit memorized. But then don't forget, she had just gone through the training, so like catechism classes, so it's not unusual that it would be right on the tip of her tongue. So, having said all that, what do you think? What should we do?
Take guardianship of the child.
take guardianship and upright. In the back?
Yeah, I would do surgery and get rid of the death and say we didn't.
That's another option. I'm not sure we considered that option, but that is one. But that reminds me of another case. Oh, we don't have time for that.
You face that kind of responsibility every day?
Not every day, but we have a lot of issues, but some of these are more challenging than others. This was one of the most challenging. I think adolescence. Yeah, I think adolescence is one of the most difficult.
Well, if I understand correctly, they would just not be able to. They would be ostracized from the rest of the hall forever and ever. Amen. I mean, they have certain rules and regulations. They don't forgive. You know what I mean? You're ostracized. You're not allowed to come to the meetings. So it has grave implications for the future of her family unit. And
there's some truth to that, but I think there's an overblown misperception of that. I think that's true if a person voluntarily says, "I want blood." Then the Jehovah's Witness community shuns them. In fact, they are, what's the word they use? Disfellowshipped.
Yes, disfellowshipped.
Right. But if it's imposed on them, that's not the case. And that's another whole discussion, and I went through another case where we addressed that issue. But so I sort of minimize that in my analysis of what we're going to do. But to cut to the chase, I felt that it was ethically permissible to honor her belief because she was acting as a mature person. Now, that was a judgment call. But because we had legal precedent, we can't just do it and ignore the legal precedent. So I called her hospital attorney and said, "I'm suggesting that we go to court and ask for what's called judicial relief, which says, 'Your Honor, we understand that this is the legal precedent, but we would like relief from that obligation because in this case we think this child is mature.'" That's what I suggested to the attorney. He says, no, that won't work. I think it would have worked. But he said, "What we need to do is to report this child to Child Protective Services as a medically neglected child, and there will be an adversarial proceeding in court. There will be lawyers appointed on both sides, and we'll duke it out." So I wrote a letter to the court because I had to be out of town on the day of the hearing, and I sent a copy of my consultation report. And the judge, in her wisdom, said, she asked how urgent it was. "Well, we have a few days." Said, "All right, I want you to try to find another surgeon who is willing to operate without giving blood to try to honor their beliefs, and then we'll have another hearing back in 7 days." So we called 1-800-NO-BLOOD, Honest Engine. There really was. It's no longer, but there really was a phone number like that. Now it's a website. And we found, about 50 miles away, we found a hospital and a surgeon who were willing to take over care and not use blood products. The family were reluctant to transfer because they felt to been getting good care, but they did go, and I don't know actually if they operate or not, but I did get a thank you letter from the family several months later saying that she had survived. Whew, it's a relief. But what if she had died? That's heavy. But that's the sort of case that we're talking about when we're talking about bedside ethics. So professional standards, legal standards, ethical standards, religious standards. Oh, yes, we do have some standards that apply in the religious community. Then there's the issue of a Christian ethicist doing ethics consultations in a Christian hospital or in a secular hospital. And I've done them both. Fortunately, during my training at the University of Chicago, I worked primarily at the University of Chicago Hospital, but I also was seconded out to a Catholic hospital. Very pleasant to work with the nuns, and so no, not all the staff and not all the patients were Catholic, but at least we had this umbrella of faith in which we could operate. So that was just 1 year. And then I went to Loma Linda in Southern California, which is a Christian medical school and a Christian hospital, in pictures of Jesus on the walls, in a Christian mission statement and so on. And it was quite easy to talk with patients about their faith, to pray with patients and so on. And I was there for 10 years, and then I decided to come back to Vermont, took a position at the University of Vermont Medical School and Hospital. Not a Christian environment. In fact, an anti-Christian environment. And it's really been a horse of a different color. I've only prayed with patients, I think, 3 times in 7 years, as opposed to frequently in the previous setting. And I've had to be very cautious about what standards I put into the consultation report. Now, fortunately, many of the Christian standards that we have, the biblical standards, are consistent with a good practice of medicine. So in most cases, there really isn't any conflict. But when I get asked to do a consultation about abortion, it's tough, tough role. So that's just sort of an overview of bedside ethics consultation. My second role is going up the ladder one step to teaching medical ethics. And I've been teaching now for 17 years or so, medical students, physicians, nurses, social workers, chaplains, and so on. And the issues in the curriculum are, and I put in capital letters, autonomy is at the front of the list, capital letters, because it is the most important concept in contemporary secular medical ethics. I am the master of my destiny. I will be in charge. It's behind the issue of informed consent and so on. The question?
Accountability. Accountability in the context of autonomy?
In a sense, yes. Do you understand what will happen if you choose this? But if you choose this and you understand, then that's fine. I'm a believer in patient autonomy, but I do not think that human choice is the highest good. I think there are limits on human autonomy. And so it's been a challenge to try to teach in a secular environment. But other issues like consent and competence, whether the patient is able to make their own decisions, or are they too young, or do they have dementia, or are they too sick? And if they can't, then who is the appropriate surrogate to make decisions for them? Issues about limitation of treatment. Futility is a real hot button. When can the physician say, I'm sorry, that just plain won't work. Even though you want it, we're not going to do it because it's futile. And there are pros and cons to taking that position and so on. Conflict, justice, economics, right of conscience. Right of conscience is a really current big issue. Because we have said for at least a generation that a physician or a nurse or any other healthcare professional may say, I'm sorry, in good conscience, I cannot do that. I cannot participate in an abortion. I cannot remove the feeding tube from that patient or whatever. And that healthcare professional is excused and somebody else takes over. That's been the standard. But that standard is being questioned. The patient is autonomous. The patient has the right to demand whatever. And some people are saying, you, as a healthcare provider, as far as I'm concerned, that's a four-letter dirty word. I think professional is a better word, much better word. But you, as a provider, are obligated to do what the patient wants. And so I'm fighting mightily for retaining the professional's right of conscience. But then, in teaching, I can teach theory, all these issues we've talked about, but I teach primarily by cases, and by making students and physicians jump through the hoops, just as we did with that last case discussion. But so when you're teaching, what's the basis of decision making? Well, there are three different ways that you can look at decisions. One is based on principles. And there are 4 generally accepted principles in secular medical ethics. Non-maleficence, which is, first of all, do no harm. Beneficence, which is, while you're at it, do some good. Autonomy is the patient has a right to make up their own mind. And justice is non-discrimination. We should treat like patients alike. Those are the 4 foundational principles. And they're taught over and over and over again. And they're very important. And from a Christian perspective, We must recognize those, but I think we have a bunch of other principles that apply to the Christian mindset as well. And I'll come back to those in just a moment. So principles is one way. But a second way, and a way that some find preferable, is virtue ethics. I, as a person, I, as a physician, am unable to do that because it's outside of the boundaries of what's considered acceptable. If you don't have a religious foundation, then virtue can still be a strong modulator. But third, and the lowest, in my estimation, the lowest on the list, is a consequential way of looking at things, a utilitarian. How do we get the greatest good for the greatest number? And if both religion and professional virtue are excluded, this becomes the default. And this is the way doctors and nurses think a lot. What's going to happen if we do this? What's the good and the bad, and how do you put them on a scale, and how does it all weigh out, and so on? And I use consequences in doing analyses, but I think consequences are not adequate by themselves. We need some other standards. And so what I would like to add to this secular reasoning is such things as medicine as ministry. What does it mean to be human? The imago Dei. The fact that each of us, each individual, has within him or her the image of God and what that means. And the whole worldview of a fall and suffering and death and atonement and eternity. The sovereignty of God. The issue of miracles. Miracles is tricky because the word is so misused today. People, oh, look at that miracle drug. That's not a miracle. It works. This is how it works. You know, it's a miracle that we can go to the moon. That's not a miracle. It's good engineering. Miracles cannot be explained. They are when the laws of nature are broken. That's a miracle, when we have supernatural intervention. I don't see many miracles. I can think of one that quite possibly is a miracle. But most often, we see some really unusual, unexpected things, but I can't really convince myself that they're miraculous interventions. Issues of stewardship and dominion, all these things I think should factor into our reasoning. So let's move on to the third level of public policy. Because rather than being at the bedside, or rather than teaching, we're now talking about policy. And it's a different animal. It really is. I don't consider myself a public policy person. But issues, I mean, I'm involved, as you are, and concerned about things like abortion and transplantation and limitation of treatment and feeding tubes and advanced directives and stem cell research and physician-assisted suicide. I mean, I've been on the hot seat on physician-assisted suicide for the past 5 years because it's been on the legislative agenda for the last 5 years in Vermont, and I've put together an organization to oppose this. So how do we look at policy as opposed to individual patient? Well, there are medical ethics think tanks that have been established, some very prominent secular ones, the Hastings Center, the Kennedy Institute, and so on, and there are many others. And there are a few small, barely recognized Christian ethics think tanks, the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, housed on the campus of Trinity International University in Deerfield, Illinois. Christian Medical and Dental Society has a very active ethics commission, which develops position statements on policy issues and so on. And there are others, too. But I've thought a lot about this, and because of that, put together, or was invited, actually, to submit this manuscript that you have before you that's just coming out this month, The Role of Christian Belief in Public Policy. And I would be glad for some feedback on this, because I'm not sure this is entirely correct in this analysis. I think it is, but I would like some positive or negative criticism. So to start out, I talk a little bit about the history of Christian involvement, looking at Carl Henry and Francis Schaeffer and William Barclay and how they stepped outside the box and were involved in their communities, and how people like William Wilberforce and Theodore Weld were involved in the abolition movement, Christians speaking out in public about public issues. With this sort of conclusion, I guess you would say, that Christians should be verbal, should be vocal, should be speaking out, should be salt and light, and should be making a difference in the community. Well, what kind of action? Well, John Stott, I think, is sort of my guiding beacon on this. He said, when we're talking in the public arena, we should try to persuade people by argument, try to convince them of the moral correct way. But when it comes to a matter of legislation, it's really hard to know. Let me just read one line from Stott. It's not always necessary to invoke moral beliefs to produce good results. He's talking consequentialism here. But he's saying that it's possible to argue from a prudential basis, saying it's not a good idea to do that, even if your own motivation is from a spiritual basis or a biblical basis. Probably the best historical example of that is what's called the Belmont Report. Back in the 1970s, after there'd been so many revelations about unethical research involving human subjects, the Nazi physicians who did horrible things to prisoners of war, the Tuskegee study in which poor black men with syphilis were studied to see the evolution of syphilis, then even after penicillin was discovered, it was withheld from them so that the disease process could be studied further. And there are Willowbrook, and there are a whole bunch of others. And so the government established this commission to come up with some guidelines on how we should do research. And two people sat on that commission, Al Johnson and Steve Toulmin, both philosophers, and they noticed something very interesting. The people on the commission came from many backgrounds, theistic, atheistic, different cultures, and they fairly easily came to some conclusions about what should be done. But when you asked them why it should be done, they gave totally disparate answers. And so they wrote a book about it, The Abuse of Casuistry, in which they said that casuistic thinking, which is case-based thinking, has gotten a bad rap. People think it's just relativism, and it really isn't, because people are judging these cases based on their own moral background, their own moral intuition. And so their bottom line was, it's possible to reach consensus on what should be done without necessarily agreeing on the morality of why. And I think that's where John Stott is trying to lead us. And then let me give you a personal example in relation to physician-assisted suicide. I helped put together this organization called the Vermont Alliance for Ethical Health Care with two goals in mind. One, to enhance end-of-life care, to make it better, and two, to oppose the legalization of assisted suicide in Vermont. It's a secular organization made up primarily of healthcare professionals, and we argue against legalization based on bad consequences. If we do it, this is the next step. This is what's going to happen. Deterioration of the doctor-patient relationship, abuses, expansions, and so on. Well, over the last 5 years, I can't tell you how many times I've been on panels and discussion groups and so on. And one time early on, I was invited to present one side of the issue at a county medical society meeting in Burlington. There were about 75 physicians there, and each I and the person who was supporting legalization each had 10 minutes to present our views. And then it was question and answer. And the first person who stood up said, Dr. Orr is being dishonest. Said he's a member of the Christian Medical and Dental Association. He's on the board of directors at the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. He's a right-wing Christian. He's trying to force his morality on everybody. And he sat down. And the room was very quiet. And I prayed very fast. And what then came out of my mouth was, I think everybody in this room has a worldview that affects how they think on this issue. It happens that my Christian worldview is consistent with the 2,500-year history of Hippocratic medicine that says we don't do this. And I think that if we do this, the consequences are irretrievable. And I said, and if you were listening carefully to my remarks, that was what I was arguing. I didn't say anything about morality or religious belief. I said, if I thought this was just a religious issue, I'd be preaching in church. I wouldn't be speaking at the County Medical Society. And so then the discussion went on from there. But that brings up an important issue, and I'm not sure that I've got the right focus here, and I'd be glad for your critique. The issue of tolerance and compromise. Where does that figure in the public square? And I remember hearing Bishop Fulton Sheen. Any of you old enough to remember Bishop Sheen? You don't look that old.
Thank you. I am. I'm on TV.
Yeah. I used to watch him on TV when I was only this tall. It's great.
I was only that tall.
I heard him speak at a presidential prayer breakfast back in the 1970s, and he said many pithy things. But one thing that I'll never forget, he said, I'll never forget it. Oh, yes. He says, tolerance applies only to persons, never to truth. Intolerance applies only to truth, never to persons. So we should be intolerant of falsehood, but tolerant of individuals. And so even though some Christians get hives when you mention the word compromise or they mention the word tolerance, I think when we're working in the public domain that we have to be able to tolerate people who have different beliefs from us and try to work together to come up with a consensus that's consistent with our worldview, recognizing that sometimes we may fail. And I think with that, I have a quotation from Pope John Paul II talking about this very question. When it is not possible to overturn or completely abrogate a pro-abortion law, an elected official whose absolute opposition to procured abortion was well known could licitly support proposals aimed at limiting the harm done by such a law and at lessening its negative consequences at the level of general opinion and public morality. This does not, in fact, represent an illicit cooperation with an unjust law, but rather a legitimate and proper attempt to limit its evil aspects. And that's sort of the approach that I've had in trying to work with this. I mean, I see a clear line in the sand about assisted suicide. I see a clear line in the sand about abortion. I think abortion always takes a human life, and I think that's always wrong. Now, some of you are going to try to take away my Christian card when I say what I'm going to say next. But I think there are some times when abortion may be the only option. For example, a woman who is pregnant and an ultrasound determines that she is carrying a baby that cannot survive outside the uterus. It can live as long as it stays inside, but once it's born, it's going to die. And she says, I have 15 weeks left in this pregnancy. I'm carrying this doomed baby, and every time I go to PNC, somebody says, oh, you're pregnant. When's the baby due? Is it a boy or a girl? What's the name? I can't stand it. I can't stand it. I'm going to decompensate. I think it's still wrong, but I think it may be certainly understandable, maybe justifiable for her to request early termination of the pregnancy because of the psychological burden. But I think it's a pretty small box, and I would encourage her to continue the pregnancy, to get some support, to cuddle the baby when it's born for the few minutes or hours before it dies, to get some bonding there. And my experience has been that when women do that, and the fathers as well, there's usually a better long-term outcome. But I'm not walking in their shoes. I'm not going to PNC with them. And so I'm not willing to stand here and say, thou shalt not. So on that grim note, I will end the formal discussion and open it up to comments, questions. Yeah.
The Oregon, the only state with physician-assisted mm-hmm. suicide, has there been an experience of other consequences? Is that enough?
The question is about Oregon and whether or not there's been adverse consequences from their legalization. It depends on who you ask. The numbers that come out of the Oregon Health Department indicate that only a few assisted suicides are happening and that there are no bad consequences. However, if you read the newspapers, you read about cases of patients with early dementia, cases with people with severe depression, people who have shopped around among several physicians who were unwilling and finally found somebody who was willing to write. So on our website, vaeh.org, we've accumulated 12 cases that we're aware of where there have been abuses. So I think there are adverse consequences. And it's required to be reported, but there is no investigation. So somebody reports only if they feel comfortable about it. So if they have a case that didn't go well, they're probably not going to report it. So the reported numbers may look good, but I'm not convinced that the actual practice is that good. Yeah?
How does ethical consideration interact with liability considerations in making some of these determinations?
The question is the interplay between ethics and liability. And this comes up not infrequently. When there's a disagreement between, usually between family rather than patient, family and the healthcare professionals about whether to stop treatment. And the physicians are often concerned, well, what will be the legal consequences if we do that when we think it's not a good idea? And the question often in the ethics consult is, what does the law say about this? And I think we have to be aware of what the law says, and we have to not intentionally violate the law. But sometimes we may have to request judicial relief or act outside the law and be willing to go to court and defend it, saying, I did this and these are the reasons. So I think there's a lot of overlap with law and ethics, but they're not congruent. That there are situations where something may be, there are many situations where things are both legal and ethical, some situations where they're illegal and unethical, but there are some where they're legal but unethical. And some whether ethical but illegal. And I think we have to be able to cope with those. And my role is as an ethics consultant, have to have some knowledge of the law, but often will recommend that the physicians get a legal counsel as well as the ethics consultant. Yeah.
I know back in the 90s, early 90s, mid-90s, there was a huge debate between the palliative care community and versus the physician-assisted suicide. How has that changed since the early 90s, mid-90s? Because that's the research I have is from then.
Right. Well, the question is about palliative care and hospice and how that overlaps with issues of physician-assisted suicide and so on. And I think you're absolutely right that, I mean, hospice was in North America, was a relatively new invention in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. Cicely Saunders started it in England, came to Montreal, and then down to Hospice of Connecticut, and it's sort of developed. But when it started, it was a counterculture. I mean, it was against the mainstream medical profession. And it's taken 20 years for it to be accepted as a valid and good part of medicine, such that palliative care has developed as a specialty in medicine. And today, compared to 10 years ago or 15 years ago, palliative care has a slightly higher profile, better acceptance, and there are more training programs in it, and there is more required training in end-of-life care. Still, not nearly enough. I was teaching over at Union in Schenectady, New York, just a couple weeks ago, and one of the physicians there told me that they have just now, and I think they may be the first medical school in the country, just now instituted a mandatory rotation in hospice for all their medical students. I think that should be nationwide. Because, I mean, yes, you go into medicine to save lives and stamp out disease. That's fine. But people die. Yeah. And we need to know how to take care of them. And I was the volunteer medical director for the first hospice in Vermont back in the early 80s. And I found that one of the most rewarding parts of my practice, to be able to look back after a patient has died and say, you know, things are better because I was there. And we got the nurses involved and the social worker and the chaplain, and we gave whole person care to this patient and their family. So it's slow, but it's coming. And it is the answer to physician-assisted suicide. That's not the answer. The answer is to do a better job of taking care of people.
Yeah, you talked about not asking why. I'm trying to remember exactly what the context was. When you make a decision and you say, everyone sort of agrees that this isn't a good idea, but once you ask why, then it kind of gets crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of the, I've been reading this book for like 10 years off and on, The Abolition of Man.
The comment is about C.S. Lewis writing in The Abolition of Man about arguing against the subjectivity of values, that there is some objective truth. And he goes on to point out, I think he calls it the Tao, that there is this, and I think some philosophers or theologians would call it natural law, that there is built within the human heart. Whether you're coming from Buddhism or Taoism or Shinto or Christian, that there is a basic natural law. And I think there's nothing to that. I mean, I'm not a scholar in this area, but I think you're absolutely onto it, that we may be able to develop consensus on what's the right thing to do without articulating the chapter and verse of what makes it right. Good point. Thank you.
How does your belief in eternity or in the afterlife sort of interface with the ethical determinations that you're making with medical ethics? I'm assuming it's different than someone who thinks that death is the end and that life is sort of the only...
Right. I'm sorry for smiling. The question is, how does my view of eternity square with this, because it may be different from a secularist? I wrote an article a few years ago in a British medical journal about patient requests for treatment that were based on their religious beliefs. Sort of the flip side of an article that had been written earlier on patient refusal of treatment, like the Jehovah's Witness refusing blood and so on. And I said, and a colleague of mine, we wrote this, and we gave half a dozen cases, where a person's religious belief may lead them to request specific treatment because of their beliefs. They're waiting for a miracle, or God said she's not ready to die yet, this sort of thing. And in the discussion of the article, I said that I felt that religious beliefs were an important part of the calculation, and a person's belief about eternity or not, might play into the calculus. And that a person who requested treatment that the healthcare team felt was futile, really wasn't going to work, it might be appropriate to provide that for somebody who had a religiously based request. And boy, did I get shot down, or tempted to be shot down, by an atheistic philosopher. He wrote a response, scathing response. Fortunately, the editors had the grace to send me his response and allow me to respond in turn in the same issue. And he made it clear that he was an atheist and that ethics was talking about real truth, whereas religious leaders are talking about supposed truth or whatever. So he was talking about this objectivity of truth. And so my response to his response was that a confirmed atheistic worldview is a religious belief. And that if a person says, I believe that death is the last thing that happens, therefore I want you to continue treatment as long as possible because I want to postpone death as long as possible, I think that's a religious belief that should be honored. And he didn't respond to that. So I think we may have made a point. But I think it's true that as I talk with patients, especially about end-of-life issues, I always ask about the patient's worldview, what's been their spiritual history, practice, and so on, and how that enters in. And some people just blow it off. Not religious, doesn't matter. And other people, it's a critical part. And some people have a it's going to sound judgmental, but I think a misunderstanding of religious tenets. They may think that we are obligated to do everything possible to postpone death as long as possible. I don't read that in Scripture. I mean, I think we are condemned to die because of the fall. And we're all going to die unless Jesus comes first, returns first. And I think we have to work within that. And a person of faith has an eternity to look forward to after death. So it should be less of an issue for a person of faith.
But that's the prevailing keep people alive. You have to get somebody's permission to not do that.
It was. I think things are changing. The comment was that the prevailing ethos of medicine is that we must keep people alive. And I think that was true 20 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago. But there's been an interesting flip in ethics consultations. Because when I first started doing consults, more often it was families wanting to stop treatment that doctors felt was appropriate. More recently, it's been the flip of physicians wanting to stop treatment and patients and families demanding that we continue. And I think some of that is the loss of the religious worldview and that patients and families are wanting to continue on because this is the end. Some of it, unfortunately, I think is economic, that the families are saying, look, you doctors just want to stop because it's costing so much. And so it's an interesting mix of how we got there. But I think the wind is changing. I think there's less of this concept that we have to postpone death as long as we can.